This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto, and I believe we are joined by Zafar Bengash. Are you there, Zafar?
Hello, good morning, Phil. Yes, I am. How are you?
Well, I'm doing well, and we're really glad to be talking to you. The situation, obviously, on everybody's minds is what is unfolding, and it's almost an hour-by-hour thing. I'll bet you know more up-to-date the news since I closed the door in the studio. Things change quickly. But I need to ask you, let me ask you, first of all, your reaction. I just said something about the conduct of governments given this really threatening crisis in the Strait of Hormuz, Iran, Israel, U.S., the Spanish prime minister says he's moving his embassy, reopening it. What do you think of that?
Well, Spain has been not hostile to Iran. In fact, he has been very vocal against the Israeli government policy, particularly with respect to its attack on Iran and what Israel has done in Gaza. So the Spanish government obviously is in a better position than many other European countries, and now of course Italy is also coming on board over there. But Spain has been quite vocal in condemning American-Israeli attacks on Iran, and it seeks to try to limit the damage that is definitely being inflicted on the global economy as a result of Iran shutting down the Strait of Hormuz, because Iran has been under siege and under sanctions for 47 years. Millions of people have been affected, which is an illegal act by the U.S. and its allies. And so what we witness is that when Iran took action in the Strait of Hormuz, which has lasted only, let's say, a couple of months, then the whole world is screaming and complaining that this is illegal. We need to ask whether, you know, those sanctions on Iran are legal, whether America freezing Iran's more than $100 billion worth of assets is legal, whether the U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran is legal, whether the assassination of Iran's top leaders is illegal, whether attacking a girls' school, killing 168 young girls aged between 7 and 12 is legal.
And that was a double attack, right?
They hit it twice in the same day. Exactly. It was called a double tap. That, you know, when the first missiles struck, they destroyed the building. And when the rescuers arrived to try to see if they can rescue any girls trapped under the rubble who may be alive, then other missiles were fired so that these rescuers were also killed. So a total of, I believe, something like 180 people were killed, of which 168 were these innocent young girls. So, you know, when we look at the world and the way, you know, some people talk about legality and illegality, etc., there is so much double standard that it's mind-boggling that you know, people would miss this point. But I think, I feel, generally speaking, that most of the world, at least the people around the world, have woken up to this reality. They are not buying into this propaganda of the U.S. and Israel and some European countries. And they also see that Iran is a victim of U.S.-Israeli aggression, and that has gone on for more than 47 years. So morally, politically, diplomatically, Iran stands way shoulders above anybody else, and it has shown that even in a state of war, it does not resort to the same kinds of criminal acts that the U.S. and Israel carry out.
The Spanish action seems to me to be the logic of, if the world's people are, just as you said, actually frightened and angry with what is clearly an out-of-control, militarist, hegemonic policy of the U.S. and fearful of what might come. And at the bottom of it is clearly they intend to, the goal of the U.S. is to eliminate the sovereign government of Islamic Republic and to even dictate who will be there. So action such as Spain's really goes to the heart of it, because Spain is saying that is the legitimate government and we're opening our embassy. I want to move to the other, of course, crucial business. One is, are there talks? Can you speak of Pakistan's role? They seem to be playing balanced or stronger. They've established some sort of strong position. I've read that at bottom, the reason Pakistan was chosen as a place for mediation is that they don't have any foreign military, U.S. military bases. Is that your take on it? What do you make of the role of Pakistan?
Yeah. Well, first of all, as far as the issue of talks is concerned, Iran has quite clearly indicated that they have not agreed to any talks for the simple reason that the Americans are completely untrustworthy. And if you follow the tweets that Trump hammers away daily on his so-called Truth Social, it's full of contradictions. There are threats. Then he says, "Oh no, everything is fine. We are the Iranians have agreed to all of our conditions.
We won. It's over."
The Iranians have not agreed to anything. They have said that you people are unreliable. We don't have any trust in you, and we will only talk once we have an agreed framework to talk. And they've also said that, the last round that was held on April the 11th in Islamabad, which lasted for 21 hours, every hour, J.D. Vance would call Trump to report to him as to exactly what was going on, what was taking place.
Yes.
And although a number of issues were agreed upon, that is what I learned from people in Pakistan, as well as the statements that were issued by Iranian negotiators. It was only when Vance got a call from Netanyahu that the American position immediately changed. Despite having agreed to a number of things, it immediately changed. It became very hostile, and that is when the talks collapsed.
Yes.
So,
Can I ask you right there? Isn't it bizarre that Trump says, "Okay, we're participating," but how can you deal with what is actually a tag team? On the one hand, you're talking to a major power that's already bombing you, but there's a second party, and there's no guarantee that he can control that second party. I mean, why shouldn't that be in headlines? We're going, if this deal is struck, that means that Tel Aviv is going along with it, because otherwise it's worthless.
Exactly. You see, if the negotiations were strictly speaking between Iran and the U.S., I think the two parties may be able to come to some agreement. Although Trump is a totally reliable person, and the Iranians are very, very careful about it. That is why they are insisting that whatever agreement is arrived at, that it's not that Iran would agree to the terms that the U.S. has stipulated, mm-hmm. but that the U.S. also has to fulfill the terms that Iran has stipulated, which means, for instance, unfreezing its assets, which means that the sanctions have to be removed, that Iran can freely and openly sell its oil on the international market, that Iran's right to control the Strait of Hormuz has to be recognized, and that Iran is not going to ship any uranium out of its territory, that it is willing to cap enrichment, and the enriched uranium that it has, it can downgrade it by, there are various mechanical means to reduce it to lesser grade, that means dilute that enrichment. But Iran is not going to forego its right, which has been guaranteed by the NPT, of which Iran is a signatory. And if one reads the articles of the NPT, one finds that it guarantees Iran's rights, because it's a signatory, that it can enrich uranium, it can use it for peaceful purposes. Yes. And nobody in the last 30 years has proved that Iran is making a bomb. This is a nonsensical.
Yes, and they're the only ones that have been inspected.
Exactly.
They actually allow international agency, which, by the way, one has a good reason not to trust, but they allowed them to actually inspect them.
Exactly.
And you have two nuclear powers that don't allow anybody to inspect them.
Correct. And not only did Iran allow inspections, but it allowed them to install cameras over there. It allowed them to inspect these facilities unannounced. Like, I mean, you know, Iran went out of its way to prove to the world that it is not pursuing a nuclear bomb. I mean, I'll give you my personal opinion. I wish Iran would, because, you know, look at the example of North Korea. Once it acquired a nuclear bomb, then America is no longer threatening North Korea. But you compare that with, for instance, Libya, when it gave up its nuclear program, or with Iraq, when they gave up their chemical weapons. Look what happened to them. But, you know, of course, it's the Iranians' choice. But my personal opinion is that Iran should have a bomb. Then America and Israel would not do the kinds of horrible things that they are doing. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, Trump is threatening to blow up their power plants and their bridges and their roads, etc.
Yes.
These are war crimes. And America and Israel both are guilty of these war crimes. So we see that this whole situation is so bizarre that on the one hand, Iran is required to do certain things which it is permitted under international law, but America is demanding that it should not be doing.
Yes.
And on the other hand, Israel and America are getting away absolutely with murder. Now, when we come to this aspect of, you know, Pakistan's role, I think Pakistan wants to see this issue resolved because it is affected directly. To give you one example, there is a gas pipeline from Iran to Pakistan, which Iran has built up to its border. And this gas pipeline was built and signed back in 2012. But the Americans said that they demanded of Pakistan that they should not buy any gas from Iran, because if they did, then they would be violating America's sanctions, illegal sanctions. And so Pakistan is basically forced not to buy gas from Iran, which would save it billions of dollars every year. And instead, it was forced to buy liquefied natural gas from Qatar, which cost a lot more to Pakistan. And even that has now been stopped because of the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. So Pakistan obviously has a vested interest in seeing that this situation be resolved, and also because it is a neighbor of Iran, and any instability, any damage to Iran, any conflict with Iran has a spillover effect on Pakistan as well. So of all the countries in the region, definitely Pakistan has a great stake in seeing that this issue be resolved amicably.
There must
Although I don't really have much hope that, you know, Pakistan would be able to have much influence on the United States on the erratic behavior of Trump, because, as I mentioned, Trump keeps on changing his mind every second minute, and so there is really nothing that one can go by as to what the position of the United States might be at any particular time.
Trump does tend to incinerate his own allies, and he puts them in a spot where many of them are thinking of quietly walking away, or maybe not so quietly, Pakistan has another neighbor to the east, very much interested, I suppose, in that pipeline, and that would be China. I notice the Chinese are more and more uncomfortable with what's going on because an Iranian vessel returning, I think, from China was fired on by the U.S. Did I get that right?
Yes, that is correct. It was the commercial ship Tuska, which is Iranian flag. It was coming from China. It was bringing goods, and it was going to dock at the port of Bandar Abbas. And the Americans not only fired at it, but they boarded it, and they have taken it under their control. And Iran has said that that's an act of piracy, that we are going to deal with it, we are going to respond to it effectively. And when the Iranians say something like that, they do fulfill their promises. They do not let these matters go. And so what the U.S. is doing is it is now drawing China also into this. Although China would like to see the Strait of Hormuz open, as would Iran, incidentally. Iran has always said that we don't want to close the Strait of Hormuz. What we want to do is that this has to be not just a unilateral action. There have to be certain conditions met by the other parties as well. So while Iran is fulfilling its obligations, America is not. So when Iran announced that it is opening the Strait of Hormuz, which was Friday evening, April 17th, the very same night, Trump issued a tweet on his Truth Social that the American blockade of Iranian ports and vessels will continue. So Iran said, okay, if you do not fulfill your obligations under the ceasefire deal, then we are not going to allow the Strait of Hormuz to be open. So the next day they announced that it's going to be shut. And so since April the 18th, which was Saturday, April the 18th, the Strait of Hormuz remains closed to hostile vessels. Iran has allowed vessels from friendly countries to pass through, but not from countries that are hostile to the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Zafar Benghazi, Crescent International. There's also some sign, or maybe not, I'll ask you, that these Gulf states who decided to attach themselves to the United States and Israel, really embarrassing moment, that some of them are a little uneasy now about their allowing the U.S. to have bases. I saw some report that the UAE was saying, well, we don't actually need the bases anymore. We can defend ourselves. Is that true, and does that represent some sort of uneasiness and retreat on the part?
First of all, in a general sense, the countries in the region that have U.S. military bases have realized that when it came to the crunch that America was not there for them, that these military bases were supposed to protect them, but America used these military bases to carry out attacks against the Islamic Republic of Iran, and Iranian officials had always stated that if any military bases in the region are used, that we will take a retaliatory action. And even the New York Times actually admitted that all 17 U.S. military bases have been rendered out of action as
really?
A result of Iran's
17.
Retaliatory.
Yes.
17, that is correct, 1-7. There are a total of 19, but two of them in Oman are on the other side of the Oman Sea. Mm-hmm. So Iran has not taken any action against them, but all the other bases, whether they are in Bahrain, in Qatar, UAE, in Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia, they have been taken out of action, and billions of dollars worth of equipment, radar equipment, planes, and other sort of military equipment, these have all been rendered inoperable. And you are right that, you know, there was a report from one of the commentators in the UAE. Actually, it was an article published in one of the UAE newspapers in which he said that, you know, we don't need American bases because when we needed them to defend us, they didn't defend us. Although Iran has been very, very careful that despite the fact that these bases are being used to attack Iran, Iran has not attacked any other facilities in these countries. It is only targeted those military bases plus any infrastructure such as oil-producing facilities when Iranian oil facilities have been targeted. So, for instance, when Iran's refinery was attacked in Tehran, then Iran retaliated against refineries in the UAE and in Kuwait, etc. So today the situation is that these regimes, these Arab regimes, particularly UAE, Qatar, Kuwait, etc., they are unable to produce any more oil or any more gas because they do not have any storage facilities for them. That all of the oil and gas that is on the loaded on the ships, on the tankers, there are about 600 of them, they are stranded in the North Persian Gulf region. And so they have to stop production because they can't store any more of that oil. The only country that is actually able to continue to produce and to ship is Saudi Arabia, because it has an export terminal on the Red Sea. But even there, if the Saudis take any action against Iran, then the Ansarullah, or as they're also referred to as Houthis in Yemen, yes, they've said that they will close the Bab al-Mandab Strait, which is very narrow on the Red Sea. And so the two basically exit points from that region will be blocked, and that would have a very, very serious implication for global energy resources.
By the way, so I have to ask you right there, because now that's a new development that is very dramatic. Israel has established an embassy in the so-called Somaliland.
Yes, of course.
And apparently the Saudis do not like that.
Correct.
What's that about?
Well, basically, what the Israelis are doing is to have a foothold on the other side of the Bab al-Mandab in what is referred to as the Horn of Africa. And, of course, Somalia itself is very unhappy about it. So the Israelis are trying to create a foothold over there, which obviously will not go down well either with the Saudis, definitely not with the Somalia itself, and other countries in the region that are very, very uncomfortable with this Israeli encroachment in that area. So obviously there are a whole lot of...
It makes it harder for them all to be aligned with Israel as silent partners, while Israel shafts them basically on the Horn of Africa.
Yes. Yes, of course.
I mean, how can they face their people?
Well, unfortunately, they don't pay much attention to what their people think or what their people say, but definitely it increases pressure on these regimes. And there is no doubt that they have come to the realization that they have to adjust their policies, because so far, they were relying on the U.S. to defend them, and the U.S. has refused to do so. And so now they have to come to terms with the new reality, which is that Iran is now the indisputed regional power, and they have to come to some sort of an agreement with Iran in order to maintain peace. Yeah. I'd say that to Iran's great credit, they have always said that, you know, we want to maintain friendly relations with our neighbors. We don't have any hostile intent. Mm-hmm. And the security of this region should be the responsibility of the countries of the region rather than of outside powers. And yeah, outside powers are really basically a source of instability. Despite the fact that, you know, these Arab countries have been very hostile to Iran, even so, Iran has not shown any hostility towards them. I mean, to give you one example, back in July of 2017, the Saudis had actually laid siege to Qatar. Mm-hmm. And it had blockaded Qatar. No food was entering over there because most of Qatar's food supplies were coming via Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. Iran immediately stepped in, and they started to supply millions of tons of food to Qatar. and they saved Qatar from virtual starvation. Of course, that siege of Qatar lasted for 4 years, or less than four, 3.5 years. Because in January of 2021, then the Saudis realized the futility of their siege. It wasn't working, and so they made up with Qatar. But I'm just saying that, you know, despite the fact that these Arab regimes have been hostile to Iran, Iran has been, in critical moments, very helpful to them.
Absolutely.
And so it indicates Iran's good intentions.
And remains a leader, truly a leader in the region.
Absolutely.
Can I ask you, Zafar, in the remaining about 2 minutes, I am really bitter, frankly, that the way the supreme leader of the Islamic Republic, Khamenei, has been spoken of, including by a prime minister who called him evil the day after he had been murdered, assassinated. Could you give us a quick profile of Khamenei? Because he has been martyred and barely remembered properly.
Absolutely. Well, you know, he's remembered with great reverence in Iran and by hundreds of millions of people all around the world. Unfortunately, the attitude of Western regimes, including of our own government here in Canada, has been extremely, extremely hostile. And I'd say, quite frankly, absolutely atrocious.
And disrespectful, inhumane.
Absolutely. He was a great man. He was a great leader, a very humble person. Just give you a couple of examples. I mean, you know, the day he was martyred, he was sitting in his office. He was fasting, which this was the month of Ramadan. He was fasting, an 86, 87-year-old man. And at that time, he was reading the Quran. So he was, in all senses, involved in spiritual, religious activities, number one. Secondly, his advisors had told him ahead of time that your life is in danger, that you should move out of here, you should go to some safe place, etc. And his response was, if you can provide safety to the 93 million people in Iran, then I will go to a safe place. Otherwise, my life and that of my family's life is no more precious than that of an ordinary Iranian. I want to ask, is there any leader in the world that has that kind of, you know, concern for his people? I mean, he was a man of God. He was not just a political leader. He was also
and
a
he
religious.
Lost his arm to terrorist attacks.
Exactly, exactly.
He this survived an attack by terrorists. He knew about terrorism, but it was directed towards the Islamic Republic.
Yes, exactly. This was back in June of 1981. He was actually a member of the Defense Council, and he had gone to the war front, and when he came back, he was speaking at a mosque in Tehran, and that is when a terrorist bomb, you know, struck him. He was very seriously injured. He spent a whole month in hospital. He had chest wounds. He had, you know, facial wounds. His right arm was completely paralyzed. And initially, doctors were not hopeful to save him, but, you know, God had to save him, and he was saved, and he was then able to serve his people for 37 years.
I'm very glad you could sum that up for us. Zafar Benghazi, Crescent International. Please come back sometime shortly, because I want to talk even further about that individual, because I think it's a disgrace he was not supported. Zafar Benghazi, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is Phil Taylor, Taylor Reports, CIOT, and 334578, Steve Fruitman is coming up.